Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Initech.
No, you're working at Initech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm tomorrow, Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 57, 58. SP Futures up 258 as we have allegedly, through, I guess, a third party, have sent Iran a 15-point plan to end the war. Well, let's hope that works. War's ending is always good, so I'm not so sure who that went through, but it's got the market up, it's got oil down, it's got everybody feeling good again here, so let's hope it actually works. That would be nice. We have Professor Kevin.
Hey, good morning.
How are you?
Doing all right. Hey, just to give you a heads up, I got to jump in the car at the bottom of the hour, so I'll be offline for a minute.
Are you going to film the jumping?
No, I just take a running start and jump.
Just like in the movie The Big Chill where the guy landed and like broke a rib?
That would do.
If I tried it, I probably
would break a rib.
A lot of stuff going on, sports-wise and business-wise. I've been very concerned about, well, nothing I can really do about it, but that even before the war started, the people in, I don't know who you blame for this, I guess you blame everybody, the inflation numbers, I don't know if you listened yesterday, Kevin, some of the inflation numbers that people are reporting to me are off the chart, stuff doubling from last year, and I especially like the part about the people on Social Security. Their Medicare Part B and their supplemental is totally eclipsed by a long shot the raise in Social Security themselves. So they're net loser on the year. You know, this kind of stuff really starts to grind on people. The simple things like somebody was telling me about their some tests they had to go for, and the doctor said, just go because it's only $60. And the nurse says, yeah, it was $60 last year, it's $120 this year. You know, that kind of stuff. We're not talking about $60 going to $62. I mean, stuff is like going up 20 and 30. Well, so I was sort of fearful and anxious to get the money supply numbers, which for some reason Joe Biden decided not to give people the weekly numbers anymore. He's not to give us the weekly numbers, but I'm assuming somebody gets the weekly numbers that is more deserving, I guess. And the current president has not, of all his executive orders, he hasn't reversed that one. So the number you get is still for the month of February, even though we're March 24th it came out. This is before the war, and it shows worse than I even ever dreamed, essentially a 10.5% annual rate increase. And we've got, you know, Fed bozo telling you things are, might be 2.7% this year instead of the 2. And you got President Bozo saying there is no inflation. Kevin, I think we're going to be 6 or 7 if these guys don't cut it out. And I don't see it being cut out with the war on. That's why I'm really anxious, other than people dying, for this thing to be over. And otherwise, I think we're on a long slope to somewhere, and I don't want to go where the somewhere is. And if this keeps up, we could be looking at 8% rates by September. That would not be good, friend.
Don't know where we're going, but getting there fast.
Huh? We are. I mean, did you, give a just when you think things can't get any worse, I stumble on this YouTube thing yesterday. I'm looking to see the end of some basketball game, and sure enough, there's some lady talking about the Middle East. It was like the real what the hell is it? The real something something in the Middle East. And I go, what is this? Some lady who's on there, she sounds like she knows what she's talking about. And just, you know, every time you read or hear something, Kevin, it sort of gets worse. She's talking about, for everybody else in the world, conflict in the Middle East means oil for you, basically. And all we look at is our gas prices going up through the Strait of Hormuz. And she says the real issue in the Middle East for people who live there is not oil, but water. And I guess I could have guessed that, but it is a desert, duh. And I knew, and Bill Moriarty was telling us about how they do have desalination over there and what it takes to, you need a lot of energy, and they do it. They don't boil the water anymore. What did Bill say? They use filters or something? Some kind of particulate filters or whatever. Anyway, but she rattles off all these countries, and there's 70%, 75%, 60% dependent on desalination. And evidently, all of them have like one or two facilities, and pipelines coming from the facilities. And she goes, if somebody really wanted to be pissed off, if they landed anything on these facilities or on that pipeline, you're not talking about an oil pipeline. You're talking about nobody can drink. She says the danger in water in the Middle East for the people there, those facilities are way more important than the oil facility. I had no idea about that, Kevin. I guess I should have, if you asked me the question, I probably should have said, well, yeah, those guys need some water. I know they do some desalination. I had no idea it was like 70-75%. Did you?
No, but it makes sense. Yeah.
But I guess their populations have grown a lot. And then she starts rattling off, the oil prices and our biggest ally, Japan, who evidently is getting caught in a vice in the where you don't want it in this deal. And she starts talking about, because the dollar's been strong and the yen's been particularly weak, if oil gets 110 bucks a barrel, which, Brent was, and it's down today, thankfully, it's really $1.30 for them if you add the currency drop that their currencies had in there. And she's in Japan, she goes, is a big debtor nation now. I mean, they don't have any dough. If they start raising interest rates, then they got a real problem, because they've gone from like 0 to 2.5. Matter of fact, I'll look right now to see where they are. But they were like, zero for a decade or more. And now they're, where am I going here? There we go, bonds. Japan's 2.25, sorry. And she says, if they get caught, the only thing they really can do is they've got $1.2 or $1.3 trillion of U.S. bonds. They need money. The only thing they can do is start selling U.S. bonds, which is exactly what we don't want here. But it kind of accentuates, Kevin, which I think on the show, all of us, even though we joust about various subjects, we really do all have the theme that all this stuff is tied together, isn't it? You just can't do one thing, can you?
No, there's a lot of moving parts. They need to be coordinated. So, Japan needs Hormuz-proof energy, and the U.S. has it. So last week they did a deal with Japan for $60 billion in investment in natural gas production in the United States to be able to do a lot of exporting of additional nat gas to Japan. And then they're putting another like $40 billion into building small nuclear reactors in the U.S. So that they can, and some of them would be on their behalf.
What good is a nuclear reactor here do Japan?
If it depends on where it's built and what the energy export is. If it's a technology share, then a joint venture, then you do it in both places. You accelerate your process.
It's not like there's a power line going across the ocean.
No, and I didn't say that.
I know. But I mean, I don't...
You can bring it up if you know.
I mean, we'd have to have it under the ocean, but that'd be tough, too. I'm kind of surprised that this whole, when you start talking about every one of these countries kind of in debt, not just to their own people, but to other people on top of it. If it's your own people, it doesn't do any good, right? I mean, if all of the debt the U.S. had was internal, even though people would be pissed off, Kevin, it really doesn't matter, does it? So it's like you owing your wife. The house is still flat, right?
It's on my relationship with my wife.
Yeah, well, it's a. But what I'm saying is, if like during World War II, I would guess that with people buying the bonds here, I don't know this, but I think I would probably make a bet that 90% of the money bonds sold to the government were sold to people here, right? I would guess.
I would think so.
So if all of a sudden, I mean, the government couldn't pay, I mean, people would be pissed off, but it doesn't really harm you worldwide, even though it would be kind of a tough thing. But I was actually thinking the other night, Kevin, during one of these basketball games, what if these long-term rates did go to like 8 or 9%? What could the government do about it? I mean, when you don't have, I mean, it would be, you'd really have to think outside the box, and I don't know. I think we come up with a solution on stocks and jacks? It'd be pretty tough.
I don't know. Russell will be on later. Let him solve it.
He can solve it. You know what? He'll get the answer from Larissa, and he'll tell us that it's him. That's the kind of guy he could be. That guy.
You're telling me he's going to plagiarize her ideas?
No, he'd embellish them.
Yeah, I see.
He wouldn't know play, but that's a bad word. He does that.
That's a bad word, and in the academic world, it's a really bad word.
Oh, God, yeah. Hey, I got a question for you. One of my clients wants to be invested a little bit in AI, right? So they have some of the Google stuff, which is Gemini, right? It's Google's?
I believe so, yeah.
Who's Claude? Is that...
I forget who owns Claude.
Is that the AI, the Anthropic or whatever?
Yeah.
Is it those guys?
Yeah.
What are there any differences in those things? Or
They have low-end stuff, too. They have, you know, ChatGPT type stuff, too.
Okay.
If I wanted to invest in AI, I would be looking and I've told you this before, I would be looking at use cases. I would be people who are actually applying what we call AI is really, juiced up processing is the state of the art as it exists right now. And so when we're talking about that, we're talking about people with the use cases. So you're looking at people who do maybe environmental impact stuff, depending if that's an area where you want to invest. Demand planning is a big AI application right now that a lot of people are adopting, and there are people who have engines in it. Another one is digital twins, and that's actually an area where NVIDIA has a whole software suite built around that. And digital twins is just creating virtual versions of products, of plant and equipment, of factories, of warehouses that companies are using to, when they're opening anything new, to do and test the layouts and the workflows before they do one bit of work on it, so that they're really optimizing, or if they have to rework something. And that even goes down to grocery stores evaluating, how many checkout lines they should have, how many self-checks, how many regular checks, all that kind of stuff. And then product level, if they want to, if they're looking to re-engineer a product, they can test it in a virtual world first, and then apply it. So those are the kinds of in the AI field, those are the kinds of applications that I think exist now, and people are making money doing it. So if I were looking at it, that's where I would be there.
Well, here I have a.
There's a whole bunch of use cases. You can talk about environmental impact. You can talk about routing. But just in the supply chain world, I can probably give you 10.
Well, this is coming from somebody who traded in the OEX for 20 years. We essentially traded the market, right? One of my, we have a lot of clients at PTI, and it's real easy, Kevin, to protect and invest in, quote, the market with the really good ETFs. I got the Qs, you got the spiders, that kind of stuff. Or if somebody wants we have a lot of people that wanted to be in oil this year, and boy, they're having a nice year because you got in the XLE, which was an absolute dead dog last year, but it sure as hell isn't this year. We've had pretty good luck in the XLV, which is the medical part, And I would really like to get involved for this client and some others in the AI stuff. And I really wish there was, maybe there is, a basket of 10 of the stocks you're talking about. I mean, I really don't want a basket with NVIDIA 90% of the basket. You know what I'm saying? I'd really like to, I mean, going, I guess what I'm saying, I love the area, but I'm not confident in my or anybody else's ability, to be quite frank, in picking out the one company out of the 20 that you're talking about and saying, oh, this is the one. I mean, that's a tough do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wish maybe I will look today to see if somebody has a, what do you say, almost like a distribution AI ETF or something, type of that. Something like that. Is that what you're kind of here talking about?
Yeah, if you wanted an ETF, that's what you'd be looking for. But yeah, I would be looking for people who are actually selling you something that you can use to make money or save money right now, rather than future stuff. So, you know, a lot of people are betting on NVIDIA, you know, rolling out all kinds of generation after generation of processors, and they are. But I think even NVIDIA understands that it's really built around the software what's important.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would like to get the 10 companies you're talking about. I'd like to buy them all, basically, because then I think you're right on this one, and I think I would like me and my clients to be a part of it. I just don't want to be the guy to pick one out of the 10 and assuming it's the winner. Because, you know, I might win and I might lose, right? And I don't want to do that. I'd rather just win. Just saying.
Wouldn't we all?
Yeah, wouldn't we all? You know, same thing on the defense side. So I have clients that say, well, what about stuff in the defense? So I write Lou an email yesterday and I go, Lou, you talked about some of these companies and he basically has said, you know, you know who the big guys are, the Lockheeds and people. There's been so many combinations in that area that it's really becoming. Yeah, well, how many companies did he go back, 40 years, Kevin? He sent that thing out a while back to us. There were like 60 companies there. They're down to, 10? You know, Honeywell's involved and Lockheed, but it's all kind of scrunch, General Electric. So you can go with that, but now then what percentage of the company is going to be defense? And even Boeing, what would you guess is their defense? Is it 20% of their business? 30? I don't even know. But say it'll go to 40 if they have to make a lot more missiles or something. But then he said a lot of the smaller guys that make all the bullets and things, you know, actually bullets, are a lot of mom-and-pop places that aren't even public. He said a lot of the places doing the high-end software stuff, a lot of those are in Denver, and I thought he said those guys, a lot of those are startups. So again, you know, I don't want to be in a position for a client to say, out of all these companies, here's the one type of thing. You know, I'd like to be able to get involved in a group of them if I could, and I'm going to maybe work on that next couple of days. So I'll ask Lou about that tomorrow. But, yeah, I mean, picking the industry is a lot easier than picking the stock, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, hey, what's going on with the I had thought, and you watch them a lot more than I do, the NCAA, the girls, I had thought that talent had been spread out a lot. Remember, 15 years ago, it was the Irish and, you know, four other teams. It seems like it's back to that, isn't it? I watch it.
It is to a degree about who has to, who's out there. But we have seen, you know, for instance, you know, Iowa was a power when they had Caitlin Clark. But it was Caitlin Clark, an extraordinary player, and a bunch of others, you know, with her, who some were pretty good players, but they're not, you know, they're not that caliber. You also have, you know, there's a few players who are out, and you can see the difference in them being out. For instance, Connecticut won last year. It's no coincidence that for the first time in 3 years they had Paige Beckers healthy, and what a difference that made. Because before that, what did I say? It was like 2016 before. Yeah. That was the last time before last year.
Yeah, the coach had serious hair then.
Yeah, he did. Now it's great.
Yeah, and not as much. Funny how that happens.
But you also see some up-and-comers, you know, and they have their stars. So, like, you're going to see the Irish on Friday are going to play Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt's got a big-time star player. Their coach is a woman named Shay Ralph, And she was a long time, she played at Connecticut, and then she was an assistant for a long time at Connecticut. And then she's been, you know, probably about 3 years at Vanderbilt. She is going to be the one who's in line to replace Auriemma when he retires. But she's building a powerful team. Southern California, a year ago, they went into the season with, you know, one of the top five picks from last spring named Kiki Irifin, who has become a young star. But along with that, Juju Watkins, who got hurt last year and has been out all of this year. So it's, you know, you do have a lot of emerging teams, but when you get reliant on one or two stars, and then those one or two stars gets knocked out for a year, as happens so often in women's basketball, all of a sudden you've just, you know, sent that team back to among the all others.
Well, there was the game the other night, UConn played somebody who was pretty good. Yeah, Kevin, I'm watching. It was after the Irish played, and it's 60-10.
Yeah, they beat their brains in.
I mean, it wasn't a 16 seed either. It was like a 7 or 8.
Yeah.
So I mean, it looked like my Park District team playing the Bulls, for God's sake.
Yeah, UConn has an extraordinary team this year. I mean, if this is Geno's last hurrah, you know, he's going out in style. They're two best players. If you know, when you get a chance to see them. One of them is Azy Fudd. I know she had Notre Dame as a finalist when she chose UConn, and she was another one who had an injury earlier in her career and took, you know, time to recover. The other is their center named Sarah Strong, who is just an extraordinary player, and I think she's only a sophomore, so she'll be there for a while. Though, you know, sometimes you just get a team like that that is really, really good. But UCLA is really good. South Carolina is really good. LSU has had some really good teams. So, you know, I don't think it may still be concentrated at the top, but it is not just UConn like it once was.
You can't fail to notice that the coach at LSU, she always does something kind of bizarre, doesn't she?
Kim Mulkey's crazy, and then she has the whole her attire is let's say it's trailer park chic, and I think Mulkey really I think she embraces it.
What was she wearing the other night? Was it a construction zone thing? It was some weird outfit. It wasn't even really like a dress or slacks, or I don't know what it was. I don't know.
You know, a lot of people think she's nuts. A lot of people don't like her. I get a kick out of her.
Oh yeah, is the girls set up the same way in terms of get paid for victory as the guys? And what are the? I know I'm jumping you with this.
I don't know the number, Tom, but yes, they earn the same way.
So the what are the guys up to? You have any idea, or we push that to Friday?
No, haven't looked this year, so I don't know.
What was it last year? Was what, $200,000 a game or something? Was that 3 years ago, 4 years ago?
Oh, yeah, I think they're higher than that. I think they're probably way over three now.
And then you get it for what? How many years? 10 years? 7 years?
Six.
Six? Yeah. It's a... Does the play-in game count?
Yeah.
Okay, so Miami... I always root for whatever reason. I root for the... here's the reason. I root kind of for the underdog because... The Big East has been so crummy that I keep rooting for St. John's and Connecticut just so the other people in the conference get some money and not just the Big Ten teams. And, you know, it seems like they...
The Big Ten, it's so damn big that they have to split things equally throughout the conference. So it is sort of diluted.
What do you make of the... I haven't had a chance to talk to you since I heard the guy talking Friday night. Regarding the state of basketball, there's only one, not top 7 or 8 seed left, right? Is it who is it? Somebody's Texas is the only.
Yeah, Texas had to play in.
Yeah, and they're an 11, right? They're not a 16, so but I'm saying they're the only, shall we say, underdog left in the thing. It's getting more and more concentrated, it seems. By the way, the coach from St. Mary's out in California just took a big job. I don't know if you saw that. that guy's...
No, I knew he was in demand.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. This year, a few years ago, didn't those guys have the huge Australian connection? The 1 year, like five of their starters, five of their starters.
Yeah, they had a big Aussie. They always have, yeah.
But they weren't very good this year, though, I don't think.
I don't think they were a tournament team. I don't think they were a bad team either.
Well, so the one guy was talking about if you don't have a $10 million budget, you might as well forget it now. Well, out of the 68 teams, how many of them do you think have a $10 million budget? But I have no idea. You know more than me. I mean, obviously Marquette doesn't, because now they're beating up on their alumni to come up with dough because they want their team to be good. And that's kind of a lot. What do you suppose the real big teams have?
Well, a lot of it's kept it quiet, but you may remember we had an article last year about Duke, and that a bunch of very wealthy investors approached Shire, and they said, whatever you need, you get. Now, that could be investment in facilities and things like that, but you have to understand the NIL rules now. The schools, what the school can pay is limited. So the rest is arranging for deals that are going to pass muster with the NCAA's clearinghouse. And so, they can't just give people money for showing up. They have to actually do something now. That's the rules. Do people break the rules? I'm sure they do. But that's the rules. And right now there's a problem with people being promised deals and then they choose a school because of the deals that were promised with a third party, somebody who is a sponsor for the school or, does advertising on the school sports or, whatever. Notre Dame refers to them as their Team Notre Dame sponsors. And then if the agreement that they make to promote that company or that or some products doesn't pass muster, they ain't getting the deal. And so the school's got to scramble and find something else for them, or else you're going to have a very, very disappointed player. So that's the big issue right now in NIL. You may be saying I need $10 million to play or $12 million to play, or at the top, or Duke gets has $20 million worth of it. I mean, how many ads have you seen this week with the Boozer and his kids?
Oh yeah,
Boozer or his kids. How many do you see with Arch Manning, the quarterback of Texas, and so on? So some of those are really big deals, and they, obviously they do pass muster, but this is how, this is what gets people paid. This is what that big number budget is. And so it really gets down to all these schools. Can they arrange these kinds of agreements for the players that they want to sign? And that's, that's their challenge right now, because if it gets bounced back because it's not legit, they just can't say I'm paying you to be here. You have to actually do something.
But who's
for it.
We talk on the show every day about nobody enforces any rules, Kevin. I mean, what if, let's pick our favorite player, Hannah Hidalgo. She gets the big deal with Red Bull, so her deal says she's going to get whatever, pick a number, $1 million, and she has to do 4 or 5 commercials. What happens if she never does them, or she doesn't show up, or they say screw it, we only want 3? Does she get the money back? Does anybody look? I can't see.
I expect Red Bull is going to claw back the money if they can.
Well, I mean, maybe they don't want them. I mean, I was saying it could be on either side. God, she was terrible in the first commercial. We're not going to do the other 3. I mean, I guess who's the snoop hound from the NCAA that actually enforces this?
They actually have a group that does this, a committee, and they have to evaluate everything gets submitted to them.
I'm trying to split hairs here and say they're going to approve the quote deal. Who approves that the deal is actually followed?
Don't know. Okay, Tom, I got to jump off for a minute.
All right, so we'll do a break, and we'll catch you when you come back. SP Futures, besides, we got a nice break here because market's way up. SP Futures up 63, NASDAQ Futures up 278, and maybe we're nearing an end of a conflict, which would sure be nice. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This is a true sad story for ADT, the leader in home security systems. My favorite dog, Oliver, was stolen from our garage recently. If I had a camera system installed in my home from ADT, I would have known exactly what car possibly pulled up in my driveway and stole my little friend. If I had a security system from ADT, my dog would still be here. I called ADT this weekend, and they're coming out in a few days to install a camera and a new security system. Unfortunately, it's a little too late for me. Listen, protect everyone you love in your family. Call ADT now. Have them come out and give you a quote to install a full security system in your home. Don't let it be too late for you. Call right now.
Paid for by the Home Security Hotline. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. That's 800-200-6543.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, Andrew on the board. S&P Futures up 66. NASDAQ Futures up 290. Everything is pretty green here today. Except for Chevron, it's down 242, but they've been up so much. We don't care about those guys being down. Everybody else is up. We've been down a lot, and we were down yesterday, so we're down 184 in the NASDAQ. Now we're up 280, so we were yesterday plus 100, and we're kind of double, a little over double on the S&P. So it's a pretty good bounce back here. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 385. Now, these guys have been getting hammered, but that's 1.7%. What's he up 1.25? 125, that's 1.3. CAC around up 125, 1.6. So very bullish across the board in Europe. Asia, which has been getting smoked. Nikkei's up 1,400. It's 2.8%. Still, I'm thinking they're way off their high. Hang Seng up 272. Oh, it's a full 1%. Shanghai up 50, 1.3%. So we're green everywhere. I mean, everybody's hoping this deal works, whatever the deal is. 10-year down 7 basis points. We're still 4.31. So before this started, we were under 4. So it's crept up over 30 basis points. It's a big deal, especially when you're almost 40 trillion in hack. The Bund down 6 basis points, 2.95. Oil taking a hit, 5.62, 86.73, so under 90. Brent down 6.60, under 100, but still 97.86. So we're not that huge of believers. RBOB down 22 cents. Yay! That's 292. Okay, so you got to add shipping, handling, some profit on that, which has got to be 30, 40 cents. Puts you up to 340. 325, 330. Add a 90 cent to a buck tax that most states put on there. So we're still talking 440 gasoline if RBOB stays at 292. So hopefully that'll drop. We'll see if it continues to. Gold, with a nice bounce up 177, 45, 78. Still nowhere near the 5,100 it got to. Silver up 370, 73, 28, which is big news for our guys. We're long gold and silver, so it's a good day for the good people today. Foreign exchange, dollar, kind of unchanged. Well, the euro is back up to 116, so the dollar is actually down a little bit. And the British pound, 134. Pound had gotten down to 132-something. So they're going back up a little bit. It's one of the reasons why gold is moving that way, because dollar's going down. Crypto up 2,571,915 on the Bitcoin. That's a lot of stuff, Andrew. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
All right. It is 6:39 here in Chicago. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, there's not much going on with sports.
No, not much.
Yeah, all I got here is the Suns lost against the Nuggets. That was at 125.
The opening days tomorrow for baseball.
Okay, yeah, so we got something coming up, but again, not much today, unless you're in Phoenix, but, you know.
Those guys all left last night. They're on their heading home.
Yeah, that being said, in Phoenix, they're currently at 71 degrees. It's going to be very hot with record-breaking temperatures, the high might be 100, and the record high is 99, so there's...
They've had a brutally hot spring. They better change some of their spring training games to night games.
Yeah, they have a warning here to stay inside and stay a little cooler. Here in Chicago, we are staying cooler. It is 45 degrees, though we are definitely warming up throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 69, and then we can expect that to go basically right back down tomorrow as we get some clouds and storms coming in.
I think it's going to stay nice for the Cub game.
Okay, good to hear.
Pretty afternoon, and it's supposed to get cold on Friday again. We're doing the up and then down.
Yeah.
Last Saturday, I walked the pooch, the remaining pooch, short sleeve shirt, shorts if I would have had them, and was 72 or something, and the next morning it was 40. That's a difference.
Yeah, I feel that. I've been basically trying to figure out all week, okay, do I put away the jackets for the season or not? And every day I've been
wrong. The answer is maybe.
But then finally, wrapping up with Chicago traffic, not going to go through all the numbers here as traffic is pretty light right now in this building. We just got two accidents to report. It's on the inbound Stevenson heading, inbound Stevenson north at Pulaski Road. I got an accident right there. And then, let's see. Whoops, excuse me, website fail here. There we go. We have an accident on the Dan Ryan that's heading on the inbound near 43rd Street. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Well, we have, I don't know if I mentioned it earlier, if people weren't listening, I'm very concerned about this money supply number. I'm really concerned when we have a Fed chair and all the people who ask him questions don't even talk about the money supply, when obviously that is the driver. Even though the new monetary system, they claim it isn't the driver. Well, that's bull, because it is the driver. Money in the system. I mean, I wonder how do we have Kevin back?
Yeah, you do.
Kevin, how did all of a sudden people decide that money supply wasn't a deal? They just got tired of talking about it or what? I mean, I don't think anybody would you know, something more than the brain of a gnat would realize if you said, what if every person who had a $1 bill, you sent them in, you bring in your Washington and you come out with a Jefferson's on a $2 bill, right? And we come out with a Jefferson, and everybody had twice as much money all of a sudden. What would that do to prices? Well, everybody would probably say, well, they're going to double, right? Duh. It's like a reverse stock split, right? I mean, if you give everybody twice as many shares, the price of stock gets cut in half, right? Because the value of the company hasn't gone up at all. Yet, nobody wants to even talk about, you know, the Fed for the last 25 years essentially shoving money into the system, which has made people who own, you know, stock, property, whatever, totally outdistance people that just work for a living over a long period of time. And everybody is really so used to that. And so, but I think everybody, Kevin, the amount of fluff in the system, if all of a sudden something crazy happens and, you know, there was a drop in the stock market or drop, something that would cause that to decrease, and we have, you know, 30-40%. You know, you talk about, God, how can the market go down 40%? Because it's up 40% in like 4 years and kind of nothing. Same way with houses. I mean, if houses went down from 410 to 370 or 360, does anybody really think that they're ridiculously undervalued there? I mean, you know, you got to just look at it. I'm not hoping for that to happen, certainly for my clients, and I'd rather have it keep going up, obviously. But, I mean, is anybody... I mean, it's even some of these stocks that everybody says, you know, you listen on TV, oh man, you got to buy the dip. Well, yeah, you always want to buy low, sell high. I mean, duh. But a stock that's going from 100 to 400 and drops to 397 doesn't exactly mean that that's a screaming buy. I mean, you got to kind of use your head on some of this stuff. But now today, I think we probably, if we can, this stuff in the Middle East calms down, Kevin. I think we got a chance to work our way out of this. Do you think there's really a chance this thing could all just go away in the next couple of weeks?
What do you mean this thing?
Well, I mean that all of a sudden there actually is a wind down of the war, and somebody tells Netanyahu this is all you're getting, and we kind of go, and the whole area just settles down. Do you think there's a chance of that? I hope so.
Question is, who benefits from chaos? There was a Axios article last week, and Axios is a news outlet. It's certainly not anything close to a mouthpiece for the Trump administration. There, it's very liberal, so you know you can sort of take it in terms of how it's sourced. But one of the things that they had from an unnamed administration official is that what the U.S. excuse me, with the U.S. doesn't want chaos. Israel wants chaos. Israel thrives on chaos, and that may be Netanyahu politically speaking. But who else, you know, sort of thrives on chaos? Because when you look at, you know, now we're shifting, you know, away from Axios. I was just using that one quote. If you look at the Strait of Hormuz, who shut it down?
Well, the Iranians, supposedly.
I don't think so.
Well, the insurance companies.
Yes, that's particularly Lloyd's of London shut it down.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's they didn't shut it down. They said they're not going to sell you insurance.
Well, that effectively shut it down, didn't it?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't exactly.
And then they scrambled back when Trump said, "That's okay, we'll do insurance."
Well, they were going to back Lloyd's of London. We were never going to actually do it.
Now, that was the first words, though, that they had. That was the first approach they took. And that was when Lloyd scrambled back in and said, wait a minute. Because, basically, they dominate that market for that kind of insurance. And they were not, you know, all of a sudden someone's going to jump in and undercut them. And their attitude to that was, uh-oh, we better get back in here.
I thought we were going to use of several insurance companies, we were going to back the insurance companies. That's the way it ended up turning out, I think.
Well, that is the way it ended up turning out, because everybody wanted to scramble back in and say, wait a minute, we're not inviting any new competition here.
Well, we don't have 10 people in the White House that are capable of writing insurance. I mean, I don't know, that's got to be, what do you suppose, boy, Kevin, I don't want this to happen, what do you suppose would happen if some fully loaded tanker gets blasted, so the ship goes down, you all get spilled, the cleanup, what's the nut for something like that?
It's huge, but is that in anybody's interest that's involved in this conflict?
No, I mean, I don't, well, who's probably the biggest winner is Russia, right? All of a sudden, they're selling their oil, more oil. The price
to an even greater degree, the United States, because we produce more oil than Russia.
But we don't. They're fighting a war. They need, well, so are we, I guess. But their price of their stuff. I mean, their oil intake money has to have tripled, hasn't it? Now they can sell it to people and.
Actually, not necessarily. That's not necessarily true, because by easing the restrictions on them, that has helped suppress the price of oil. Because even with the sanctions, if oil ran up to $140, $150, $160 a barrel, they would make more than they're making now with the restrictions, the sanctions on them eased.
Well, it was 57 when it started. Now it's 105 Brent.
Yeah. Well, I understand it ran up like crazy, but had it not been slowed, then that would have been an all new problem or an all new profit opportunity for them. So Russia was going to win this either way.
Which bothers me, but you know, because they're the one killing people. All I do is keep remembering the pictures of the hospital she was born in, the school she went to, just rubble on the ground. So ever since I saw those pictures, I'm not real big on Russia. Just saying.
Yeah, and nobody should be. What's kind of interesting about about that situation is it seems like every time Zelensky comes to Washington, they seem to say, okay, we've made some progress. Then his next stop is usually Europe, and then all of a sudden, it's like, no, we're going to dig in on this. It's almost like the Europeans like the chaos of this whole thing too, or they just don't want to confront Russia. I'm not sure what their reasoning is, but they keep throwing wrenches into all of this stuff.
Just in terms of news stuff, Kevin, and you, since you wrote and stuff for people, you know more about this than me. I just have this really odd feeling that the movie with my favorite girl in there, Tina Fey, was it Whiskey Foxtrot and something and something, about stuff just disappearing onto like to the back page. It's perfectly easy now to go 3 or 4 weeks with the Iran thing going on and not even hear a story about Ukraine. Is it over? Is it worse?
We've been that way for quite a while.
Yeah, I mean,
It's longer than Iran going on. This goes back for a while. Our attention span is pretty short as news consumers, and Ukraine has not been a front and center. It pops up once in a while, but it has really not been big news for months, I think.
If you want to find it, where do you have to go? BBC or someplace, or Ukrainian news, or I have no idea.
Well, I think you can find some news outlets that cover it regularly. It's just not, it's not on their front page anymore.
Did you ever get, when I graduated from the University of Chicago, somehow I got talked into, not talked in, they sent me the thing, and I thought I was somewhat of an intellectual. Since then, I've dropped that thought, but I used to subscribe to The Economist. Did you ever get that?
Not as a subscription. I've certainly read some of their material.
Well, it shows up every month. Well, I think it's every month. I mean, I haven't had it in ages, but and I assume they still print it. Maybe they don't. But there's kind of the main stories, and there's an economic summary of like every country in the world if you want to read it in there. And when you get through about 8 countries, you're like, even at the time when I was kind of gung ho, and I'm like, God, this is getting boring. but there are they. I don't know if they still do that, but they would tell you. Oh yeah, here's what's going on in Argentina, and they talk about it might be 5 pages in Argentina, and then they flip to Chile, and it's you really got to want it, Kevin, because it's like economy, it's pretty damn dry, but I guess it's there someplace if you look for it, like you say, but it's just you just get immune to it, like tomorrow we'll be talking about baseball, and I guess something else will fall to the back. I can start talking about the Bulls, I guess, huh? You don't even know what's going on there because it's all of a sudden falls off the front page. Plus, there really isn't a page anymore. Do you think somebody could actually get a newspaper going? I mean, I feel about these newspapers like I do about cable TV. I don't mind buying the newspaper, but I want those guys to pay the people to do the writing. I don't have to go to 50 other places to get any decent columns. Then what am I buying the newspaper for? It's like cable. I'm paying you idiots to essentially bundle all the good stuff and give it to me, and I'm giving you a pretty good price for it. So don't advertise, the Tony and Ziva new show and tell me I got to go somewhere off cable to watch it. What's the point of that? I mean, isn't that what you think you're paying for?
Well, it is, and I will tell you, though, that a lot of the, many of the best investigative reporters have gone independent, and so they have their own, either have their own websites and podcasts, or they're involved with they have Substack, they've carved out their space on Substack. Whatever they've done, you get people like Glenn Greenwald, Catherine Herridge, people like that. Charles Atkinson is another example. They're still doing their investigative reporting, and they still have enough audience that they do well financially, that it makes sense for them to do it the way they're doing it, even though they might not be getting the reach that they got when they were on CBS or NBC or some of those. And I think Greenwald does cover the Ukraine war pretty regularly, so you could check that out. But these are people who do a good, thorough job and present all sides. They're worth a subscription, and they're not expensive, and they'll just drop material into your mailbox, so to your inbox, so you don't have to go chasing it.
Well, I guess the economics of it was or used to be or something. You would think the Tribune wants John Cass because people want to. That's a reason for somebody to go buy the paper. What is the point of having John Cass, that I have to search for him, pay separately? Even if I like the people, I really don't want 10 bills coming in. I mean, it's more the bother than the money. You know what I'm saying? That's what the newspaper used to give you, and all of a sudden they don't. Now, whether it's politics, they don't want I mean, I doubt if Mike Reich would be writing for the Daily News today, would you? If there was a Daily News or the Tribune, went to the Tribune.
He would. He would. In a lot of cases, if you know, if you enjoy podcasts, you can get some podcasts, and they're just sort of built into, you know, Odyssey or iHeartRadio or something like that. So you know, there are some that you can get a regular podcast of people and get the news that way without forking over a lot of cash.
Hey, do you think anybody's brackets are still whole?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a bunch of them. Everybody's sure, probably perfect.
Well, I told you, I got this news after Friday, but after the first couple of days, who's the big bracket people? Is it ESPN, where everybody puts a bracket in?
Well, ESPN has one. CBS Sports has one.
Well, somebody had one with 3.5 million entries. And after the first 2 days, there were only...
Could have been either of those two.
Well, the first 2 days, they only had 254 still going. And I was kind of surprised. I would have guessed that maybe the Wisconsin game would have been the one most missed.
But you said it was Ohio State.
Yeah, which I just can't get there. A 9 versus an 8. But anyway, that's I got to believe nobody's left.
Nobody's left on ESPN. Who did St. John's beat?
They just beat somebody good.
I don't know. So, well, whatever. Well, you can see
they knocked off. Didn't they knock off? Did they knock off Florida? Or that was Iowa.
Iowa knocked
no,
off Florida.
No, that was Iowa. But and that was after the last one. But whoever St. John's beat, I feel like they beat an SEC. Did they beat Kentucky?
I think they might have. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, so St. John's beat Kentucky. Well, that game, before that game concluded, there were two left. And after that game, there were zero. After that game, there was one. And then the game after that knocked everybody out. I think that was the VCU or something. I don't know.
Well, VCU beat somebody
good.
There
were two left. It was kind of fun. There were two left. And St. John's... Kentucky was like, you know, luckily it wasn't like both of them had picked St. John's or both of them picked Kentucky. One had picked each, so it came down to a final game to see who had the final perfect bracket at ESPN.
What is it, 1/2 to the 32nd power or something like that? Some bizarre number.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I told somebody, I think it might have been my wife, we were talking about perfect bracket. She says, well, what do you get? And I said, well, I think, depending on where you do it, you could get $1 billion. And she got real excited to start filling out a ton of brackets and had to talk her down.
Well, everybody has their kind of key game that they are positive of. And once you lose that one, you're totally screwed.
Yeah.
Well, now that the people are left, who do you guys like?
I've been picking Arizona all along, and I'm sticking with it.
They're playing Illinois, right? Tomorrow.
I'm going Boilermakers all the way.
I almost was going to
bias in that pick.
I almost
not
was going to
at all.
Larissa, I was almost going to pester you the other day and say, "Were you at the game?"
I was not.
Well, if the finals in this week, are they playing in Chicago? Who's in? Which region?
Michigan, and Iowa State are like the 1 and 2 that I think are in Chicago.
Okay,
that's how I know Michigan is for a fact because Purdue. I was explaining the seeding to my youngest, and she was like, "Well, why is Purdue a 2 seed? But why did they send them to the West?" And I said, "Well, it probably means that they were the lowest 2 seed because they got sent far away." You know. So, but then I had to explain that they try to keep, in the first two rounds, they try to keep teams from the same conference from playing. So they've got, you know, they got to take that into account. So you might have been on your own merit 8, but you end up being a 10 because they got to send you somewhere else.
Yeah, I had that same conversation with my daughter this week because she's asking about it.
Exact same thing, watching the Purdue game.
It's really... You know, we think of them as 1s through 16s, but they're really seated 1 through 64. Forget the play-in game, but they're seated 1 through 64. So, you know, it's really, the four number one seeds in each region are going to be 1, 2, 3, and 4, But five is going to go to the same region as four, that, you know, as the first right. number two.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like this whole weird, sorry about that. That was my alarm reminding me to take a pill. which I already took, by the way, and forgot to turn off the alarm. It sort of zippers its way back and forth like that. And so that's part of it as well. And then they decide where to send you. But yeah, you're going to get priority if you're the highest, the highest number one, the highest number two. You know, you're going to get some priority treatment that way.
Yeah.
Well, so you obviously, we have some person who likes Purdue. I kind of like him too, but I think Kevin might be right. If Illinois is maybe the one team that might be able to nail Arizona, but those guys are seemingly more physical than most. This Arizona team, they almost look like a pro team, don't they?
Well, I think of Arizona like this: is they're a team that can, if you want to play run and gun with them, they'll do that, and they will do that very effectively. But if you want to get in a rock fight with them, they'll do that too.
Who else? You don't like UConn or the Big East teams?
Not really.
Well, there you go. So are you two, Russell and Larissa, are you going to head off to Indianapolis if they make it to the Final Four?
I would like to, but I don't think I will.
Is Purdue already talking about some kind of package to get people there?
Not that I know.
I dropped Emmy off at school after spring break on Monday, and she had not heard of anything either. But you say head off to Indianapolis. Dude, I live here.
I'm talking about Larissa coming to the Purdue people I was talking about.
Well, you said you too.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can go just because you're there. But I mean, yeah. I wonder if there's some kind of a – they always would – the Irish were in a bowl game. Of course, there's more stuff in football. There was always some deal where you could go and get some tickets and stuff. I mean, I guess my question is: do the participants, how many tickets do they get, and how are they apportioned? I guess it was the long winded question, but
I don't know, but I can find out for you because the Horizon League and IU Indy, where my office is, we're the host.
Okay.
So we've got a couple of a lot of students that are volunteering for it, but then also a couple of professors that are, you know, the sports business guys that are lurking around.
It'd always be fun to watch a Final Four. Except, you know, remember Marty O'Connell? Marty used to go to the Final Four every year,
and I've been to one.
Well, he went to the one like in the Superdome, and he goes, you couldn't see anything. You were so far away.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I said I've been to a couple. I went to Indianapolis in the old football stadium before Lucas Oil. So I was for that one. I had like 17th row on the corner, but it was back a ways. It wasn't what you think of when you think of 17th row. And then I went to one in St. Louis that was at the 300 level. Well, you know that the distance is going to be a problem when they have binocular rental stands out on the concourse.
Oh God.
Ooh. Goodness gracious!
I was at the first Democratic convention that they had at the United Center. I went with your buddies Russell Duke and Chuck Henry and Bill Florsch. I tell you what, that was an experience. But we went to the skybox on the top floor. There's three levels of skyboxes. It was so bizarre because Hillary was giving the speech, and it was the echo because you were getting it off the TV quicker than her voice could make it to you from the speakers on the stage. It was the weirdest. You're up there. I'm sitting there going, how does anybody watch a basketball game from here? Or hockey?
You don't.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, you sit around and talk.
Well, we're going to... Well, next week we'll be able to...
on the TV.
Next week we'll be able to figure out who the Final Four is, and hopefully you guys will be heading to see Purdue in Indiana. I'd like to see Purdue win.
I wanted to jump in and talk about the United Center as well. I auditioned to be a Chicago
really?
Bulls cheerleader, and as a part of the audition, you run out to the floor and you dance and you do the required things for the audition. What struck me was when I was on the floor of how big it really is. it doesn't, because I've sat in the nosebleed section before, but when you're standing on the floor, you feel so small relative to the entire size of the space. It's an interesting feeling.
That's
now imagine doing that at Lucas Oil Stadium.
Right.
Yeah. or the Superdome. Oh, good Lord. Yep.
Or the Superdome. So yeah, I think going to the Final Four is one of those things that's probably cool to do once just for all the atmosphere and everything. But really, if you can go to a regional final in a real basketball arena, I would think that's a much, much better experience. Whether it's the United Center or something else, I don't know where all four locations are. They usually have at least two of them in pro arenas or something similar to it. Unless you are connected with one of the schools that's in there, you should pretty much plan to put in your ticket application a year in advance and see what you get.
Wow.
And then hope your school lands there.
Larissa, a young lady who is the assistant to the plant manager's assistant at Pullman, terrific lady, and she very attractive, and one of her girlfriends was bound and determined to become a honey bear.
Oh, no.
And
yes.
So she says, you know, I'm so nervous I can't go by myself. Will you come with me? So she goes, I don't want to be a honey bear. Come on, you're my best friend. You got to come with. She goes with. Now, you know the end of the story, what happened.
Yeah, you do.
I don't know that they were friends much longer after that. And Cindy, her name was Cindy, tells the bears, I don't want to be a honey bear. They go, what are you here for? I'm just here because of my friend. Pick somebody else. But we want you. You don't get me. I'm out of here. And she left. Well, the friend was not happy.
Well, and it's disappointing the honey bears no longer exist.
You can blame old Virginia for that, because one of the grandkids, I think, was messing around with one of the honey bears.
Ah, got it.
And matter of fact, the Bears never winning another Super Bowl, in some saloons, that's called the Curse of the Honey Bears.
Curse of the Honey Bears.
It's like the Cubs were to... They wouldn't let Sam Sienis' goat in.
Right, the curse of the goat. I remember that.
This is the curse of the honey bears, but it's not as well publicized as the goat. The goat's more streetable these days than not having the honey bears. But can you imagine what it was like to become a Dallas cheerleader? They're still really big on that stuff.
They are really still big.
I can't imagine what that tryout's like. Ugh.
And it was interesting when they were telling me about the pay and things like that, and this was many years ago, but you got paid $25 an event. So it was very, very low pay. And you had to be either a full-time student or have a full-time job to be considered for it. And it was just, it was interesting.
Well,
but I do want to ask Russell, who is your number one pick for the NCAA championship?
Oh, Purdue with the heart and Arizona with the head.
Are you guys surprised Florida got trounced? Not trounced, but lost.
I think the SEC, well, you know how I get all emotional and stupid because I hate the SEC. But I felt like the SEC was overrated and sure didn't deserve to have the most teams in the tournament. And, you know, the Big Ten's got six in the Sweet 16, and they've got four. I think I was proven right on that one. So
nobody likes Duke.
You know, they're the only number one. Well, the Florida is the only number one seed I didn't have in the Final Four.
Really? Well, because yeah. Joel is all over Michigan. Nobody likes Duke. I haven't heard that name.
You know, they just seem iffy. I don't know. They seem like they don't always fully show up. You know what I mean?
Well, the one kid's hurt, right?
Some teams that almost always dominate. Now, I know Michigan did not dominate in the Big Ten final, but maybe Purdue had more to play for. But Michigan, most of the time when they've played this year, they've really just dominated the game that they're playing in.
What do you, before we go on to a more important subject, what do you think of these tournaments? I don't know, Kevin and I were talking a couple weeks ago, and back when... that was the guy's name. Left-handed guy played for Notre Dame, and he had a big career in pros.
Troy Murphy.
They really thought, Mike Bray thought he had a real tournament team, a really good team. And He was not at all unhappy to lose on the Saturday or Friday night in the Big East tournament. He's like, I don't need my guys getting beat up two more nights in a row, and I'm worried about next Wednesday. I mean, you wonder if a team like Michigan, after 3 days in a row, what does it get you?
You want to win your conference.
Well, you do, but I mean,
I know, but for as far as for the NCAA seeding, actually, I don't think it impacted them at all.
No,
you know, all they had to do was make it to that championship game. But that's the funny thing about that Big Ten championship game is, since we get the bracket right after that game, they pretty much have to have in mind what they want to do with those two teams, regardless of the outcome.
Yeah, I would think Michigan was going to be number one no matter what. And obviously they were.
Yeah. And, you know, Purdue may have flipped from a 3 to a 2 or something like that. And that's about it.
Well, I mean, I think everybody, Purdue can beat anybody. I mean, all these teams.
If they show up, there's just this, you know, sitting there with Emmy, my freshman at Purdue, and she was home for spring break, and it was just great because I got to watch both games alone with her. And while we watched both games, she sounded like the most miserable 75-year-old fan whose team had never won anything ever. Oh, they're going to blow this. They always blow these things. Why don't they play consistently? I was like, oh, my God, I'm sitting here with my father talking about Memphis State.
What?
She sounded like the grumpiest old man.
Who's the cartoon? We'll never make it. It'll never work. Who's that?
Oh, that's Eeyore.
Yeah.
We'll never make it. Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah. Sounds like that. What? Did you guys happen to catch, I don't know, I sent the thing yesterday. I was horrified at the money supply numbers that came out yesterday. And I was really hoping that Larissa was here, and she's here today, because some of the inflation stuff this weekend that I came across, we're not talking about stuff going up a little bit. I mentioned this earlier, I'll be quick. One of my friends has to go get this, doctor said, here, go get this test. It's a simple test. Just pay for it. It's only like $60. So she goes over there, and they go, well, it was. Now it's $120 this year. So we're not talking about $65 or $68. Went from $60 to $120. And one of my denizens at the bar who keeps me up to speed on Social Security is telling me, and I, you know, it's not really a joke to say the government sent people a letter. It said, we're increasing Social Security 2.3% because that's inflation, which is total BS. And by the way, your Medicare Part B is up, what was it, 6.8 or 8. So inflation for us is this, inflation for you is this. And this person couldn't wait to find me the other night. He says, you know, my I just got the thing for my supplemental. He goes, between the supplemental going up and Medicare Part B going up, I'm now in the hole. It's more than my entire Social Security increase. So I'm down on the day, which is pretty sucky if you ask me, because obviously all the other prices are going up. And a third was yours truly. I'm thinking, hey, I should buy some new shocks for my truck finally. So I go for the nice ones at Delco Bilstein's. They last year were $75. Now they're $89.50. It's not like they're $77 or $78, which I can understand because things are going up. But, you know, everything's 20%, 25%. Some of the stuff you never even think of is absolutely going to the moon here. Now, that's my unofficial gauge of this, and I wanted to get Larissa's read on this because that's the stuff you talk about all the time. What are you seeing?
Well, I'd like to first talk about the Medicare versus the Social Security and it being a net negative, so to speak. One of the things that has me really concerned is your generation, or let me rephrase that, people who are utilizing Medicare B, they don't have a choice in this. There's not a situation where if you're you're already participating in this plan, you're already collecting Social Security, you've made the choices. You don't really have the opportunity then to go out and get another job, get health insurance through your employer. You don't have that choice. So you're in a situation where you're locked into how much money is coming in, and you don't have any power to really change your spending, so to speak, because there's only so much that you can tighten up, so to speak, with your finances. When it comes to medical bills, you don't have a choice.
I think you could, I don't know if anybody's ever done this, I think you can bail on Part B if you want. I know you can drop your supplemental, but why, you know,
right.
if you want to.
If you're in a situation where you're dependent on Part B.
Yes.
Because it pays for certain things.
Well, Part B is the doctor. Part A is the hospital, which you, quote, get because you've been paying in your whole life. But the doctor is additional. If you want that, they take it out of your Social Security check. They don't send you to Social Security, then bill you and expect you to send them a check back. They just take it. So it comes out of your check. So if somebody's getting $2,700 for Social Security, they're really getting $3,300 is coming off for Part B.
Got it.
And then your supplemental, you go through, get through some other outfit.
And
but then Part D is the prescription. You're back with the government. I've learned all this from this guy because he's all over this stuff. But so every year when they tell you your Social Security is going up with the CPI, they have no discipline whatsoever to assume that your Part B goes up with the same CPI. It's a different CPI, which is, so, and the supplemental is with another firm. It could be, you know, it could be Mutual of Omaha, it could be anybody. So mm-hmm. whoever you're doing there, if they raise that, then you easily, they could have, you know, if you got if you're making 2,700, say 3,000 Social Security, what's 2.3%? It's what, $60, right? Well, if your supplemental goes up 75 and your Part B goes up 30, you're in a hole, right? Which is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. But my point was, these are situations where we have individuals who don't have that opportunity to really dramatically change their circumstances.
Right.
We're not talking about a 25-year-old who's sitting there trying to make decisions about how to invest for the future. We're talking about people who are at the end, who are drawing down from their savings. And this becomes, I personally think this becomes a real challenge for a lot of these individuals, because this, to some extent, isn't what they've been promised, right? They've been told this is what you're going to receive. These are the benefits you're going to get. And now that they're in the hole, so to speak, on a monthly basis, they didn't have the ability to chime in, make a decision, to put in their vote. And these changes just happened to them, as opposed to them being able to participate in the decision-making process.
I would agree with that for sure. Your vote, you sort of get what you get, eh?
I mean, right.
I mean, it's what I'm going to find out the answer to this, but I know if you're working for a big firm, and I don't know what the cutoff is, but if you're working for like General Motors and you're 66, you're still covered by their plan, I think, if the firm's big enough, and you don't get on Medicare until you essentially get laid off or you retire. Because right. I think I was wondering if somebody is 70 and they've been retired for 5 years and been on Medicare, what if you get a job at GM, do they have to recover you or do you stay on Medicare? How does that work?
I don't know how that works.
Because I'm sure it must happen. People go back to work in places where they're covered. I wonder if the firm has to pay for it or you stay on Medicare. A smaller firm, your people can bail off on a Medicare. But a big firm, I don't think they can. Anyway,
I don't know how frequently that happens. How many people from retirement go back to work?
More and more.
Okay.
more and more. Because, I don't know how anybody's keep. God, if you're not living in rural Mississippi, how the hell do you live on $2,700 a month?
I have no idea.
I mean, when you think about the deal, you know, this is in my lifetime. The deal with the IRAs was when all these companies started bailing on people and the defined benefit plans. People like Pullman had one, and all these people had one. As they tried to bail out of that stuff and give everybody the IRA or the 401k, which became the IRA. There was kind of a contract there that if you saved when we picked up a real lot of our clients, you know, I'm going to say 15 years ago, when we were on the score, you know, people, the number was a million, million five, Larissa and Russell. I mean, just about every couple who worked that did the right thing at the firm they were, and you save, whether it was a UPS or whatever it was, your 25 years of putting into your 401k, and if the company matched, the number came out to be a little over $1 million for just about everybody. You know, I'm talking about that level. I mean, if you were, you know, head of a law firm, it'd be a hell of a lot more than that. But for regular, and you think about, well, that's a lot of money. But if you don't have anything else in your retirement, it really came down to, say it was $1 million. The risk-free rate at the time was 3.5%. Okay, so if you didn't want any stocks, you didn't want any crap like that, you got $35,000 from the bank, you got another $25,000 from Social Security, your house is paid off, and you had $50,000 coming in. Okay, which and your taxes on that were negligible. I mean, Illinois doesn't charge on Social Security and that kind of thing. So that got you the ability to live, got you the new car every 4 or 5 years. You were able to take care of stuff in the house. Well, now, the last 7 or 8 years, the people that come in who should have the $1.5 million, virtually every one of them has been compromised somehow. Kids' education, one of the kids got didn't have hospitalization and needed a surgery. Nobody comes in with the money clean, or they had a medical emergency. Nobody has the pristine $1.5 million you're supposed to have. And everybody's struggling. Plus, the house probably isn't paid for like it used to be. And by the way, your risk-free rate was, for how long? It was a half of 1%. So, sure. I mean, the quote, you brought this up, the deal that the government made with people did not work out for a lot of people the way the deal was supposed to work out. Now, if you're in, if you bought Apple, okay, instead of, you know, with your money, and Apple, you know, is quadrupled or whatever, you're sitting fat and happy. But if you didn't, any kind of risk-free rate, you're buried. You're making 1% for what, 5 years? But that's not enough.
It's just not enough.
And, you know, we have, that's why I was horrified with that money supply number yesterday. The number for February is a 10.5% annual rate. I can't even imagine what this world is going to look like, even if we solve this war, which I hope we do, if all of a sudden the government's paying 8 and 9% for 10 and 30-year bonds. What are they going to do? I can't even think of a solution. Can you guys? You're the professors.
I have no idea. It's one of those, situations where I'm not entirely sure where they're going with it and what their goals are, but it does seem not, how can I say this? Again, when we're looking at the individuals, it feels like individuals are really hurting.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I somehow it's not percolating to the top, but if it gets worse, I mean, we're talking about $1 trillion every 100 days, the governments, and what if they have to start paying 8%? What does that do to Japan, for God's sake? Somehow or another, I see this lady who looked very intelligent, not that a lot of ladies don't. So I listened to this YouTube thing yesterday, and a lady was walking through the whole mess that if the war stuff trickles on, one of the biggest dangers to the U.S. is Japan. Because their currency has gone down and oil prices are up, they're paying the equivalent, compared to 2 months ago, of $130 a barrel for oil. And the government is deep in hack. They've got big deficits. If the one thing they have, the one arrow in their quiver, is they own about $1.2 trillion of U.S. paper. And she said if they start basically puking out that paper, this is a risk we never even thought we had. Yet they have been put up against a wall with what's going on in the Middle East, probably more so than anybody. I didn't even know that. Did you guys? I mean, the unintended consequences always seem to come up and bite you in the butt, don't they?
Absolutely. Russell, what do you think about that?
I'm a little flabbergasted at the 10% money supply growth in February, because that's before the war.
Yeah. Oh, it's 10.5 if you annualize it.
What's a bit worrisome is there's going to be a need for more money just because of how much oil has gone up. So how are you not gonna add a lot more to it in March?
You got a March number. I don't know if I want to see that one.
Yeah, that whenever I hear any kind of troublesome numbers from February, I always remember that that's before the war.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, you know, hearing, you know, the PPI, which was a bit high coming in for February, I can only fathom what it's going to look like for March.
Well, there's, I mean, you guys know this, you're the professors, but if you spend more, if you're a government, you spend more than you take in, there's only three things you can do. You can tax more, which they're not going to do. You can borrow more, which, given what this lady's talking about with Japan, maybe you can, maybe you can't. Or you print it, which gives you inflation. I mean, it looks to me like they're going to do a C here, don't you? Or they already are.
Yeah.
Yep.
This, I mean, and you know, I don't know because you're able to do that, and it kind of flies under the radar with a ton of people. I don't know when it catches up with them. But it always seems to take longer to catch up with them than we expect.
Well, I mean, some of us have been talking about it for years, and yet, you know, it's like, I know there's a cliff if we take this path. I just don't know when. And everybody's, it's not happening today. It won't happen tomorrow, right? But I don't know when this, I don't know. I think, you know, Russell and I a couple times have actually agreed that it's going to be a bad day if we get, like, a really bad auction. Now, what happens there, Russell? They just pull the auction, or do they come in with a... I seem to remember back in like the early 80s or 70s where there was an auction where the price went up like a full point or something, and it just terrorized the market.
Yeah, and I can see something like that happening if you get a buyer's strike from all the international folks. And you know, the longer end of the curve, the rates are creeping up there. And we've gone, what amazes me is that we have gone from the derivatives market pricing a cut to actually pricing the next move being a hike in rates. So I'm amazed that the stock market hasn't you know taken a look at that and reacted a little bit more negatively than it has.
Well, for the professors, meaning you two, when I was learning economics, the mantra was, Fed could control short-term rates in the short run. Long-term rates were totally out of their hands because they were inflation expectations. And for really 15 years or more, the Fed has managed to keep, maybe by buying all the stuff and putting it on their balance sheet, they've managed to take that equation and kind of stuff it somewhere. And now it might be getting out of the bag, or wherever they stuffed it, it's leaking out, because they don't control long-term rates. If they start lowering near-term rates, and you're talking about a you know an 8% inflation number, you know only a baboon is going to lend somebody money for 10 years at 4%. I mean, are we all baboons or what? I mean, we've been doing that for a while, but somewhere along the line, somebody's going to wake up, don't you think?
Yeah, especially if we you know get a really bothersome number that they can't necessarily put back in the bottle and gloss over.
Well, the PPI was rotten 2 months in a row.
Yeah.
The CPI, if you look at the unadjusted number, was pretty horrible. You know, that's...
And how are they not horrible? I mean, you've got an excuse for March.
Yeah. Well, the February gasoline number was up 1.7%. Again, before the war.
And it
got adjusted down to 0.5 in the final report. But the weird part of this, Larissa, this is right up your alley, and the CPI, they don't just, like on the labor numbers, they're just an adjustment. You know, they don't tell you how they did it. But in the, well, I guess they do give you the unadjusted numbers. Carl manages to find it. But the CPI, right on the same page, it'll tell you unadjusted and adjusted. They give you the number. The last 2 months... unadjusted was 0.4 increase and 0.5, which if you multiply either one of those by 12, you're getting what, 6 or 5, not 2. And then the adjusted number is 0.2, and then they go, okay, well, who's doing the adjusting? Who is this guy or lady? But they give you both numbers, and yet all day long on the radio, all I was hearing was how the number came in tame. If you looked at the unadjusted number, it was anything but tame. But anyway, so how is what's going on affected the class that you put every day's notes together at the beginning of the year? Are you adjusting, Larissa, or are you just getting questions and they knocking you off topic, or what?
Oh, sometimes. I have a couple of students who like to deviate and go off topic. They've been pretty good with conversations. We also ask a lot of fun questions about one of the hot topics we're talking about is the prediction markets. So they love to talk about the prediction markets. They love to talk about different things where in the prediction market something will happen and then you can see it unfold, so to speak. And some of my students have come up with some crafty things that they've been able to utilize within the prediction markets. So,
Larissa, are those things, I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to make sure. If I bet on a college game or a pro game, I'm making the bet with DraftKings, right? It's like making the bet with Caesars in Vegas. But in the prediction market, they're an exchange. There's a person on the other side of that bet, right? They're more of an exchange. You're not making the bet with the exchange. You're making it with somebody. They're just charging for the transaction, much like a stock exchange, right?
You know, I don't know. Russell, do you know?
You're exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly how it works. So, and there are... have you looked at the dollar amounts that are bet on some of these games, Chief, during the games?
Oh, no, but I
mean, it's, you know, $15 or $20 million during each of these basketball games, during the games.
The every time somebody scores, the points keep flipping, right, for the game?
Right, right. And what I don't think, what's kind of fun is I think people are learning how to become traders.
Yeah,
like,
well,
they realize you don't have to pick... You don't have to pick a winner. You just have to pick a team that might make a run during a game.
Then you pile out.
Yeah.
You're not in for the long term, the long haul.
And I did see a list of NCAA teams that are streaky for that very reason.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, did you guys, I think it was Lou sent me this thing. I thought I forwarded it out to you guys. One of the missiles, the guy made a bet that no Iranian missile would make it through the Golden Dome or whatever over in Israel. So the guy writes an article about this missile that landed short of Jerusalem, like in, you know, some uninhabited section. So it didn't hurt anybody, but the missile got through and hit the ground and blew up. So the guy writes the article, and all of a sudden they go, "You got to change this article." And he goes, "Why?" He goes, "Well, because fragments hit the ground, not the whole missile." But now fragments count because the Golden Dome intercepted the missile, but obviously you blew it up, there's stuff still going to hit the ground. Fragments don't count. The missile didn't make it. It got blown up. And the guy says, no, the missile actually hit the ground. All of a sudden, he starts getting death threats because there's like a $50,000 bet from these guys on whatever that equivalent is in the currency over there, and the missile didn't hit the ground. How scary is that?
Wow.
Yeah. Because
I don't have much of a response except for wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, now a few more have gotten through. So obviously the dome has worked pretty well, but it has been 100%. So it wasn't just this one. But they wanted this guy to change his story. So he actually checked with the military, and they go, no, the whole thing got through and landed short and didn't hurt anybody and blew up. So he said, I just checked. He puts like a retraction. By the way, I've been questioned on this story, and I checked it with the military. It did get through, and then the death threats even intensified. So somehow, it was like not paying for the Venezuela thing. All the people who bet the money on that we would invade Venezuela, and then the prediction market said that wasn't an invasion; it was just like an extraction or something. So they didn't define it as an invasion, and people were suing and everything. You know, in their mind, it was an invasion. We went and stole the president. They didn't count it as an invasion. I can't believe you guys didn't see that.
Oh, we saw that one.
Yeah, is that wild or what? But now the exchange becomes, Russell, they just become the arbiter, right? They don't have any money in the till. They just
they write it into the contracts, and it's because the CFTC monitors these guys. It's you know, the information and what defines certain things, you know, show up in the contracts for final settlement of the contracts. Like for a sporting event, I think they confirm it at three sites before they do the payout.
Okay.
Yeah, so things like that. I thought it was the Ayatollah thing, where people bet that he would be removed, and death doesn't count as removal.
Ah.
That's what I thought people were upset about. Was that the Ayatollah? I think they removed the second one as well, but through death. But that doesn't count as being removed for some reason.
Well, you're kind of removed if you're croaked.
Well, and I started looking at that betting market because I was like, well, if you can bet on these guys, you know, what are the, you know, do people really think maybe we're getting ready to go into North Korea or something like that? I started looking at it that way. And then I was like, well, which of these guys are really old and might die this year? I was thinking about it. Then I found out that death doesn't count as a payout.
Were you ever in one of the death pools? Marty Kearney's
dead. I won one with Benny Hill.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, remember, well, back, you know, this is the 80s or 90s in the OEX pit.
Yeah.
How many guys were in that thing? There were hundreds of them, weren't there?
Yeah. Ours was kind of small. It was just our Refco desk.
Oh, because Marty had, like, the biggest one. Because he had one before there was a, they got to the trading floor. Well, the best ever was people always picked the Queen Mum. And who else? Somebody else was like really old. And Danny Callahan one day yells out across the pit, "You idiots! Why do you keep picking these old people? That's why they're old. They don't die."
I love it.
Hey, we got to go to break here. I don't mind going to break when we're up. You know, S&P futures up 49. They were up more than that. Nasdaq futures up 222, but still a pretty good rally. Be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it. You could junk it. Or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not. It'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. We'll kind of make this brief because it's pretty much the same as we did a little while ago. S&P futures up 50. Nasdaq futures up 231. The big news that came out after the close last night, between the close at 3:30 and 5 o'clock, the futures opened a lot higher, was that the U.S. has somehow passed a 15-point peace plan to Iran, I think through a third party, but I haven't seen who the third party is. But so we are making an attempt, it appears, to end this war, even though Netanyahu says if we end the war now, Iran will have won. So I think there's a little bit of an issue with the two main players, being the U.S. and Israel, maybe on different ships here, and whether they want this thing to end or not. I don't know. We'll see how that works out. But everybody's pretty much bullish around the world. They were all down the last few days. DAX up 321, 1.4%. FTSE up 107, 1.4%. FTSE up, that's 1.1%. CAC around up 1.2. So everybody, a little over 1% across the board there. Asia with a nice bounce. Nikkei up 1,500 points. It's 2.8. They were down like 4% the other day. So I don't know if they're up on the week yet. We'll probably check that tomorrow. Hang Seng up 272. That's a full 1%. Shanghai up 50, which is a pretty good move for those guys. 1.3%. Bonds down, but only a little bit. Down 5 basis points, 4.33. Remember, we were under 4 when this war started. So a little bit of a comeback here, but not huge. Oil, as you might expect, this is down. Down 345, 88.90. Brent, however, at 399. It was under 100 earlier. Now it's back over 100, 100.5. So whatever the enthusiasm was on this earlier, there's still some, but not as maybe as enthusiastic. RBOB down 15 cents, 299. We've got gold with a nice rally, up 137, 4,500, but still nowhere near the 5,100 it was. Silver up $3, 72.60. Foreign exchange, dollar a little weaker. With the well, the euro was 116, now it's 115.9. British pound 133.9, it was over 134. So a little bit of a dip in the dollar, not much. The big one you want to watch is the yen. The yen touched 160. Now, careful. The yen is, the euro at 115 means it's $1.15 to the euro. The Japanese yen is quoted the other way. When it says 159, that means 159 yen to the dollar. I don't know why that's done that. It's probably a Russell question. Crypto up 1,900. Was up 2,300, but still 71,363. And a real quick traffic, weather, sports, because not much sports.
All right, yeah, not much there at all. It is Wednesday, March 25th, and it is 7:41 here in Chicago. We're just going to jump straight into weather. It is currently 60, excuse me, that's for Phoenix. It's currently 46 degrees here in Chicago. Going to be a little bit warmer throughout the day. As high as going to hit 69 degrees. Over in Phoenix, up there at 68 degrees right now. They have a heat warning as they might be reaching some record-breaking temperatures with a high of 100 today. And finally, for Chicago traffic, thankfully no major accidents to report, but things have definitely built from our first hour. The inbound Kennedy from Montrose to Jane Byrne is going to take you 20 minutes. It's looking especially heavy on the outbound from on the Kennedy from Jane Byrne back to O'Hare. That's going to take you 62 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook to Jane Byrne is going to take you 33 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf to Jane Byrne is going to take you 32. Inbound, Dan Ryan from 95th to Jane Byrne is going to take you 17 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 to the Dan Ryan is going to take you 29 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Also, a piece of news we should have lobbed out there is Iran has signaled, I don't know who's talking for those guys over there, but somehow they've signaled safe passage for non-hostile ships through the strait. So I'd say the strait is probably open for oil here as of today. Russell, Larissa, I want to comment, and we always talk about our Bob because I guess we're selfish and care about ourselves, but the real devil here has been the run-up in heating oil re-diesel. Heating oil diesel is down 29 cents today, but still $3.99, almost $4. Diesel is run ahead of, because I guess we're exporting that, has been run ahead of gasoline to some places where it's like, you know, $7 a gallon. Those trucks, when you fill them up, there's 300 gallons in there. It's a $2,100 drink. That's kind of a lot.
I think there's a ripple effect where China, right off the bat, said we're not exporting any diesel to anybody.
Okay.
I think that's why there was like a weird flip-flop on the prices there. Hopefully that'll right itself pretty quickly.
Yeah, for most of my adult life, diesel's been cheaper than gasoline, but not in the last few years, huh? I mean, really, there's no point in having a diesel car if diesel's, if you got to listen to the thing, and oh, by the way, it's more for the diesel, right?
You guys doesn't that mean you own some sort of exotic car or something?
Well, I mean, does anybody even?
I don't know.
I don't know if anybody makes a diesel anymore. What happened to all those Volkswagen diesels that got over here that they couldn't sell? They just sent them all back to Germany? There was a guy in Orland that had like 100 of them on his lot. Did they sell those things or did they send them back? You remember what I was talking about? This is like 5 years.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know if that would. Did that coincide with when they were lying about the emissions?
Yeah.
Oh. Who knows what they had to do with those?
Yeah, I don't know what to do. Go ahead, Lisa.
I was going to say, back in the 90s, my family, we drove a diesel station wagon.
Really?
That thing gave my parents such a nightmare. It broke. I don't know if it was just that particular station wagon, but it broke down multiple times, and eventually the engine was replaced for a gasoline engine.
Do you remember the brand?
I remember that it had wood paneling on it. Awesome back then.
Oh, yeah. Were you in the movie Chevy Chase's Vacation? The family truckster?
I feel like we should have been.
And I was thinking, if it's a diesel, it's got to be Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah. There's a shot. Are you accusing Larissa being up on top of the rocking chair?
I'm not saying anything.
There's a shot.
I was in the back with the dog. You know, like, that was good.
I don't think Larissa. I've met her. I don't think she looks anything like Granny. Just saying. No, Ellie Mae, maybe, you know, but the. Yeah, I mean, one of Dr. J's buddies back in the early 80s had a Volkswagen Rabbit diesel. Remember those things?
Oh, yeah.
That thing got 50 miles at a gallon. We actually rented one of those when we were in Europe, and we had four big guys in there, and we were trying to keep up with a guy going 95 miles an hour on the Autobahn, and the thing could go fast, but, boy, you didn't want to stop. The brakes were... anyway, with four big dudes in there, but... I read once that somebody wrote in and said, why don't we just make those Rabbit diesels? They get 50 miles in a gallon. And somebody said, well, if you want to make those things today, regulatory-wise, with the airbags and the collapsible front, you'd have to add 1,500 pounds to the car. Those things were so light, there was nothing to them. And you didn't want to get in a crack-up with those things, but that's what's all over Europe, right? The little diesels. But anyway... But I mean, it's a big deal for the trucking industry when you start talking about your and every state, you know, I don't know if you bring up anything this controversial in your classes, but I'm going to say the biggest single beneficiary of inflation is the government. I mean, they don't drop the price of the gasoline, and in Illinois, how they manage to do this, I have no idea. But you know, they charge sales tax when you buy gas on the other taxes. It's on the full number. It's not on.
Oh, it's tax on tax?
Yeah, tax on tax on sales. I mean, which is really something, eh? I mean, but that's what they. But the guy in Indiana, didn't he say no sales tax on gas when he got this high or something?
I don't really know.
I think the governor did that like last week or the week before, and we haven't done that in Illinois at all.
I wouldn't be surprised. That's the kind of things that they would do.
Well, it helps, obviously.
Yeah, because it helps, and it's kind of smart.
Well, the other taxes are allegedly for road maintenance. Speaking of which, why do you suppose is it just political clout, or I don't know if it's the Democrats favoring the electric cars, or Trump at one point being buddies with Elon Musk? Why do you suppose there's no tax, highway use tax for electronic vehicles? Don't you think we could figure this out? Why are those guys free?
And there should be.
Well, they're heavier
because
regular cars.
They're doing a hell of a lot more damage to the roads than our gas-powered cars.
Yeah.
They weigh a lot more.
I'm still trying to think of what brand of station wagon you must have had, Larissa.
I couldn't tell you.
I know the Oldsmobiles for a while tried to put a diesel, but they didn't go get like a Cummins diesel. They tried to take like the 350 motor and make it into a diesel, but it was nowhere near a diesel motor. I don't want to go into this, but your compression ratio in a gasoline engine, they used to be like 10.5 back in the muscle car era, but now with unleaded gas, most of them are like 9, 9.5, somewhere in there. But a diesel is like, what, 25, right, Russell? So the explosion in a diesel engine is much more violent than in a gas engine. So that's why you can't just decide to turn a regular gasoline engine into diesel, but Oldsmobile, I think, tried to do that. So I'm guessing that's you had one of those General Motors diesels that absolutely did not last at all. You're right about that. They were horrible, and I'll bet that's what you had. But anyway, I mean, you don't see people still have the diesel trucks, and I don't know if they were ever a big hit. You hear them once in a while, the guys that use them for big towing and everything, but. I don't know. They ever sell more than like 5% of the market, Russell, in the diesel trucks?
I don't think really diesel ever fully caught on anywhere.
No, but they're noisy as hell, for one.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, one of the ladies I met, and she knows you. One of my clients I met last night. She goes, the guy in the townhouse next door has a diesel truck, and when he starts the thing up in the morning, he wakes everybody up.
Oh, no.
Which is a... All right, so what is... I've been doing too much talking. What is... Larissa, what is your topic of the day? And then Russell, I mean, with all the stuff going on, I think I hit everybody up with this money supply number a little bit. But what is your top topic right now?
I'm very interested in the changes in private credit and the possible ramifications within the insurance space.
There's a number that was all over the front burner and everybody's lips 3 weeks ago, and now you never hear about it. Everything gets pushed to the next page, right?
Yep.
We talked about this like 3 weeks ago. So what have you learned since then, I guess, is the question.
There have been a few more dominoes to fall. You've gone from, you know, back when we started to hear problems in the mortgage market, it was kind of the names that you hadn't really heard of that had sprouted up that were, you know, that were doing mortgages. And I feel like that's what we've seen in the private credit space. It's firms I'd never really heard of. And then just in the past few days, you've started to hear from firms that we have heard of. You know, I know JP Morgan said something about it. I know that I don't want to misspeak and say another one said something about it, but some name firms have started to talk about how the private credit area is worrisome. The one thing that we dug out, and I mean, Larissa and I kind of did this work together, was that as far as a percentage of the size of the overall financial markets, private credit's a lot smaller than the mortgage market was as a percentage of the financial markets back then. So I don't think it's going to be as big of a problem as what happened in 2008-2009, but it could definitely cause the stock market to correct 20% off the highs.
Well, for our listeners, a lot of this, well, I'll say this, you guys tell me where I'm wrong. It kind of started with Dodd-Frank. It started with 2007. Banks have been more reluctant to lend directly to, maybe because they don't make enough money on the loans, whatever it is, they don't want to lend to the, let's say, the lower echelon. Well, other people have picked up this ball and run with it. Now, the question is, how do they get financed? Now, if they went out and raised all kinds of capital and loaned that money out, you know, if you're paying people 10% and you're charging people 15%, well, that's how you make your money. But it seems like the banks, who were kind of reluctant to lend money to, say, us, are more than willing to lend money to, you know, household finance to lend money to us. How big do you think how much of the exposure is, I guess, the question I guess I'm asking is, how leveraged are they? If it's 90% capital they raised and 10% banks, I guess I'm not worried so much about the banks. But if it's 10% capital and the banks lend them the other 90%, then I'm real worried. How big do you think it is in terms of bank exposure?
I don't know what the bank exposure is. One of the concerns that that I got from looking into this a little bit more was the exposure to the insurance industry.
Now, how are they involved? Just by lending them money?
Russell, do you know? Do you remember?
Yeah, So what they're doing is, their insurance companies are investing in funds that offer, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9% returns, based on making risky loans to companies.
Okay.
And that's where the investor exposure comes from, and within the financial industry. When we kept looking at different places that would list out the kind of firms that were investing in these, insurance companies just popped up over and over and over again. That's why, you know, we're saying that might be an area that takes it on the chin. Also, I think that's an area that people are not looking right now. They're looking at the actual fund operators, not the folks that have invested in them.
Well, the people I get, people find out that, you know, I'm obviously a big wig at PTI Securities, whatever that means. I probably get, Larissa, five a week, people wanting to hey, we can lend you guys like $1 million. Well, first of all, you can't lend money to a brokerage firm without being a partner. They're too dumb to know that. But, well, you know, it depends on the rate, depending on how whether you're good or not. It's 12 to 30%. Is that what we're talking about, those guys that are just running around trying to give people money?
Yeah, to some extent, yeah. And then, and I apologize, I do want to circle back to the insurance.
Yeah, please do.
One of the concerns that I have, this is just my personal concern, is insurance has outperformed the market substantially. And my concern is that they're outperforming because of things like private equity, as opposed to their core bread and butter utilization of insurance products. So that also has me concerned, is once you start to deviate from your core business, what are the longer term implications of this? So I'm also concerned that the insurance market is overvalued or overpriced because of these types of investments. And you know, to your point about different entities coming up to you and approaching you to give you more money, that also is concerning, right? Because why are they really trying to give you money if you don't truly need it and you're not seeking it out? Are these companies looking to just grow their balance sheet with these types of products or these types of loans, these transactions with you, even though it's not necessary? And are how quick are they looking to get it on their balance sheet? Again, when we were thinking back to the mortgage crisis, so many people were quick to sell mortgages because they wanted to grow those balance sheets. And my concern is that some of these products that are now being sold, and you're commenting that you've been solicited, it feels not correct. It feels like there's something else going on. And the reason why we're growing these balance sheets is so that we can look like we've got these great returns and we can outperform the industry, well, listen, which is what we're seeing.
But how do you find out who does what where? I mean, kind of an ancillary topic. I don't know if Russell, he knows the place I'm talking about. Insurance Exchange Building across the street. Remember how they kicked it to the bank and the note was supposed to be $165 million or something and the bank was just sucking on it basically? Last week, one of my clients who knows all this stuff, evidently they pumped it out to somebody at $30 million, Russell. So somebody, now I use the term bank because I'm showing my age. It used to be a building like that might have, the mortgage might be with Continental Bank or First National. Well, now it's not. Mm-hmm. It's with these groups of people like you're talking about. How do you ever find out who exactly, you know, took it where the sun don't shine on this $130 million? How do you even find out about that? It's private equity, like you say, but is it BlackRock? Is it five small people? How do you even know?
Well, I mean, if it's a BlackRock or someone like that, you know, they're taking $135 million loss in one place, but they probably got, you know, three gains that offset that immediately. So you don't necessarily even find that if you start to dig through their paperwork.
But is this the same part of the private equity that Larissa's talking about? I mean, what are these? Do they do building loans?
Well, private equity and private lending are two different things.
Okay. Well, I mean, if I wanted a $160 million mortgage on a building, where would I go? I can't walk across the street to Lakeside.
Well, is Lakeside Bank still a sponsor?
No.
Oh, okay, well, then we won't go there. Would we go to...
By the way, they're still my favorite bank, but...
Okay, well, then you go to Lakeside Bank because they're your favorite bank. And
to get a $160 million loan, I don't know if they can write that check.
And maybe they would say, you know, let's see if we can work with a few other banks to spread the risk out.
Well, I guess my question for Larissa, are the insurance companies, whoever, you know, they obviously have a lot of money they want to invest. Okay, that's how they make their dough. Now, are they part of these groups that do commercial real estate? They must be part of all these groups, aren't they? I would think. You know, that's the best way to do it is to be a part of a group that does it instead of your guys doing it each and every mortgage, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to find out. I mean, I find it fascinating, and I don't know how I can find out the information. You guys seem to know more about it than me. How are you finding out?
Well, we've just been finding out at the very high level what kind of firms have been being lent to in the private equity or in the private lending space, and what type of investors have been investing. And it's been, you know, insurance companies and pension funds, which maybe we should be worried about the pension fund one as well, but those aren't public companies. So we're looking at insurance companies because that's where the investment opportunity might be.
But
on the short side.
But can you find out can you go to, let's say, Northwestern Mutual, big insurance company, can you, on their, you know, annual report, can you dig down far enough to find out that, you know, that they bought $20 million in stock?
I could probably jump on the Bloomberg and look at some of these bigger funds and find out who the holders of the funds are.
Okay, so you could.
And you could. It would take a little work, but, you know, just like you can find out who the biggest holders of Apple stock are, you know,
yeah,
click of a couple of buttons. It's the same thing. It's just you'd have to go through all of these funds to see who holds them. It, you know, it'd be like, again, going back to the mortgage thing, where if you really wanted to figure out what the hell you'd bought when you bought a mortgage bond, you'd have to go line by line and see, you know, what mortgages are in there.
Well, I'm beating this one up.
Kind of the same thing conceptually.
Well, I'm beating this one up because it always seems to me whenever there's a crisis, and I'm not calling this a crisis yet, but Larissa, help me with this. There's always somebody in there to basically get their ass kicked, and you wonder, remember the mortgage crisis, Russell? We were on the air. I mean, we were talking about some bank in Germany, and I did some lecturing at banks over there. Not that I know anything about German bank. Some mid-sized bank in Germany that nobody even heard of was one of the biggest losers in U.S. mortgage loans. And I'm thinking, who are these guys? And how did they get involved?
Well, and a few of the, it's funny, I was talking about that in class last night, because I was talking about, you know, the agency bonds that aren't necessarily a full faith and credit of the United States government. And how, you know, the people had Fannie Mae bonds that didn't, mortgage bonds that didn't look all that great, and these international investors assumed that they were being backed by the U.S. government.
Ooh.
And that happened to a handful of foreign entities.
Well, that's so Larissa, what do you think you're going to find here? Something that horrifies you or no?
I suspect that if something will be how can I say it? Not pleasant. I just don't know how unpleasant it'll be.
Is this kind of formal research, or is this a curiosity?
Curiosity.
All right. Well, I hope you're not going to be like our other professor, Hal Snarr. You know, get a load of this. Hal loves to be frugal, shall we say? So he's given a paper, an econometric paper, which he loves to do at some place in Atlanta. So, actually, no, in Auburn, at the University of Alabama, at Auburn. And so he takes the train to Atlanta and rents an electric car. He goes, the thing doesn't make it halfway to Auburn before he has to pull into some place and get the thing charged up. It took him like 45 minutes to charge it like halfway. So the thing was an absolute disaster. But he gives his lecture, and he said it was pretty well received because he really digs into the mathematics of this stuff. He's the guy who's been sending us the what's he doing with the money supply, Russell? He's taking the weeklies instead of the monthlies, and if you take the progression of the weeklies, the future looks even worse than you and I were talking about earlier. But he does all this stuff. He goes, why would anybody want one of these electric cars? He goes, it doesn't go anywhere. it took him, he had to charge it back up for the, plus once you get up to 80%, it slows down so much you can never actually charge it all the way. I didn't know that, but he was not.
Yeah.
But he was very well received, giving his papers. You guys do that once in a while, don't you? When you present stuff, is that fun or is it a pain?
Fun.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I'm gonna have to come to one of these things and cheer you guys on from the back seat. If everybody else isn't clapping, I'll like clap louder so everybody else feels like they have to clap too.
I was going to say, the last one I did was in Honolulu, so that one was fun.
Yeah.
The last one I did was in Cambridge.
God, you guys are...
UK.
These guys are up across. Yeah. Lou was over there for a graduation. He goes, he loves those schools. I think he was Oxford. And he goes, they talk about the new campus is like one from like 1870 or something.
Yeah.
That's like the new one. Okay, then. Would you ever have wanted to done some school? Right, I had a chance at the University of Chicago to go to the London School of Economics my second year, and I just was, you know, school was kind of getting old and paying tuition bills, even though they weren't hardly anything.
I would teach in another country in a heartbeat right now.
Wow, because I often wondered if I should have done that.
It's more difficult to work out than that, but.
Well, because I mean, I don't know what a degree from the London School of Economics would have done me. It would have looked nice on the wall, I guess, but I just wasn't ready to hit the parents up for, like, you know, getting an apartment and everything in London. Even then, it had to be a trip, but I wonder if I should have done that. Did you guys ever do anything overseas? Did you take any classes?
No.
My niece did a semester in Italy, and it really was good for her. She's really good on the language and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it was really beneficial, and I don't know. We didn't do any of that stuff in my area. They had a couple places, but basically got in there and got out as fast as you could.
Well, I did teach in one of the study abroad classes.
Really?
But they came to the U.S. And it was great. I took the students on a lot of air quote field trips around Chicago so that they could see the floor. They could see different banks and institutions. You'll love this. I had them watch the Chicago Bears as their homework.
Really?
So that they could get more comfortable with the language, and all of their goal was to get an internship. And I said, well, you have to have something to talk about.
Yep.
And people love the Bears in Chicago, and it's at least a friendly way, and it lets people know that, you know, you are interested in things that are around Chicago and that they can will have something to talk to you about. So it was a lot of fun to teach that class. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Last question. Is Indiana going to be so foolish to build this stadium for the Bears?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
I kind of hope they do.
I know you do. I do not. Yeah.
I hope they do.
I'm with Larissa on this.
I just think, you know, if I think it's a clear indication of how poorly managed that state has been. You know what I mean? I just truly think it might be the slap in the face the state and the city need.
Well, I just
Nothing else is done.
Larissa, I think we gang up on this one next week.
Okay, that sounds good.
You guys have a terrific week.
You too.
I'd sure like to see DeBody is again one of these days. We will. Good luck on your team, and I hope you get a chance to go to Indianapolis if they make it. It'd be kind of fun. Plus,
it would be super fun.
Now, are you going to bring Russell with you?
Of course.
There you go. SP Futures up 62. NASDAQ Futures up 265. We'll see if this holds. So far, it has. We're rooting for the war being over. We'll talk about it tomorrow morning.
That's all, folks.